the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
It's Culture Club time, and we are joined by somebody who has had considerable success as a poet, but who's now published her first novel, I think it is. Dhurin Ní Gcrích, thank you so much for taking us. Is it your first novel?
I don't know if we're even allowed to call it a novel.
Why not?
They're just, I suppose, and also I'm struck by how hilarious it is to say that anyone is successful as a poet, because that's also not something that's possible. I think the kind of books I write are really strange. Where with this one in particular, and with A Ghost in the Throat, both of my longer books, say, they draw very heavily on real lives and real history, but then I try to kind of imagine it into being on the page in a way that I really do bring my imagination to bear. And so I don't quite feel comfortable calling it nonfiction, but equally don't feel comfortable calling it a novel. So I'm lost. I'm lost okay. in between.
So Said the Dead, tell us about this. What is the book about? What's the story?
Said the Dead looks very closely at a particular building in Cork, beginning in the 1890s, at a point where, and forgive me this language, it's the language of the time. At this point in its history, it was called Cork District Lunatic Asylum. And I really do flinch even saying that. And the research, throughout the research for this book, I flinched a lot, because not only in naming this institution, but also in the language that the doctors used and the language of the time and newspaper reports, it's very abrasive to our ears. And I think that that's probably a good thing, because hopefully what that indicates is that our attitudes towards mental illness and mental distress have changed so much over the intervening years, and that our language hopefully has begun to change as well.
It's only in recent years, Dhurin, because as I said to you off air just before we started talking here, I grew up in the shadow of what we knew as Our Lady's Hospital in Cork. And it was known by various people as the Madhouse or the Red Brick, until it closed, I think, in the 1980s when it was shut down. And it was a place where people went and never were released from. There was a place that just is beside the River Lee or overlooking the River Lee. Unfortunately, I can remember too many occasions when we would have heard of people who did come out and who went into the river and they were taken from the river. And there was a lack of sympathy for a lot of people at the time as well. But I think the period you're covering, it was worse, was it?
Well, I suppose I was beginning to look at this building in the 1890s and then tracing it through to the 1920s, so about a century from back from now. And in reading the case books that have survived from that institution and are now stored and very well looked after in Cork City and County Archives, it was like following the real people who were really coming through those gates, and the tragedies and rages and distresses and trauma that had been involved in their lives that had brought them through those gates were different for every single person. And I think I had certain impressions of what that history might have been like before I actually started going into the archives and reading the surviving case books. And I was shocked and astonished, although I probably shouldn't have been, that that history was different from how I would have imagined. And again, I have to say that this is a building that would, and a hospital that would have been very, very different at different points in its history. In the 1890s, it was a very different institution from how it was in the 1950s, say, or in the 1980s. Very different. And it has it has a lot of darkness in its history.
Was it a bit like a prison of kinds? Were people incarcerated there against their will simply because they were different according to the mores of the time, not necessarily because of any psychiatric illness that needed to be treated?
Yes and no. Part of what surprised me was the fact that so many people, contrary to what I had expected, recovered and went home. And I was under the assumption that once people went into this hospital, they stayed there for their lives and died there. And certainly there were a lot of people where I encountered those kind of tragedies. And that is so sad. I mean, that is a life lost. And it's just so distressing to think about that, those people who went in and were there for their lives. But what I found was that an awful lot of people who arrived at this institution arrived, particularly if you imagine someone walking up that hill in, say, 1898 or 1899, their body is described in the case books. And a lot of the women approaching that institution were described as emaciated and with visible vermin scars on their bodies. So these were people who were coming from a kind of level of impoverishment that we can barely imagine. They were women who, obviously, there was no family planning. So they may have, by their 30s, have had 9, 10, 11 children. They may have had a really hard pregnancy. Oftentimes they were dealing with stillbirth or postnatal depression, as we might call it now. And they would be brought to this hospital. And although things were always difficult there, they would be fed, and the doctors would approach each woman in a different way. So, for example, in the case books, some women would be allocated strictly a glass of wine every day, 3 pints of milk, and like 3 portions of beef or something like that. You know, that it would be different for each person, but it was tailored to each person's very particular needs as the doctors and as the institution perceived it. And oftentimes, with several weeks, months, sometimes years of care like that, these women went home to their families again. And what was interesting for someone, I suppose you could say curious or really as nosy as I am, was that I was able to kind of teach myself to follow those women who left out of the institution and back into their lives through other archives, and sometimes to see them getting married or having children, or sometimes to find them in the census, you know.
So you had an enormous amount of material to construct a story from.
Vast, yeah, vast. And also an enormous amount of lives to become deeply attached to and care about. And that was part of the challenge for me, Matt, was that I grew so fond of each of the individual people I was reading about. I cherished them so much. And it was one of the privileges of my whole life, having the opportunity to write about these people who were there, and about the doctor, Dr. Lucia, who very unusually was a qualified doctor in 1896. So unusual for an Irish woman to be in that position. And she walked up that hill as a young woman to begin working in that institution. And she moved in there and lived there among her patients, fell in love with one of the other doctors there, had her children in that building, and devoted her whole life to her patients there. So it was kind of a labour of love. I really cared about these women whose lives I was reading about, and I cared about Dr. Lucia, and I wanted to see what would become of all of them. And I think that's why I wanted to write this book, was because there came a certain point where I realised I'm gathering all this information inside my own fragile human body, and this is a body like all of our bodies that's going to die, and I don't want this living archive to be gone with me. And so I'm going to write it all down so that I hope it will come to life, and that these lives will come to life in other people's imaginations, and that they can see how astonishing and special these human lives were that unfolded within this institution.
Well, that's all in Said the Dead. I'm sure you've got loads of people interested in that now, having listened to you. But I have to move on to our Culture Club questions. And you have definitely got an original choice for the first single you ever bought. Nobody has ever claimed this one before. You have gone for Zig and Zag's Christmas Number One from 1990. Tell us about this.
It's kind of cheating because I wanted it so badly, but I had like 50p pocket money a week. So I asked Santi for it, and Santi brought me this. So it's the first single I ever bought on a favour from Santi.
Was this the time, was Ian Dempsey with Zig and Zag at that stage, or had Ray Darcy moved into?
I wonder if Ray had arrived yet. But I suppose when I was thinking about what to tell you about this, I listened back to it and it still stands. What a banger. It is amazing. And what I was really struck by, I actually had goosebumps and a tear in my eye listening to it, because Zig and Zag, like, I was born in 1981. They were so key to lot of people of my generation, in terms of like the word zany immediately comes to mind. You know, they were really, they formed our sense of humor in a really mischievous, wicked and bizarre way, I would probably say. Like, there's something slightly wrong with the sense of humour of a lot of people of my generation, and I think it's because of Zig and Zag.
Let's hear them with their Christmas number one from 1990.
Dear Santa, what I'd really like for Christmas is a four-man tent and some action figures and, yeah, cash. Maybe some
I tell
cash.
You what I want. I want a beat! Oh, yeah!
Hang on. Turn that down.
That's real groovy.
I'm trying to do my Santa list. I've only got 18 pages written.
Turn it down.
Listen
to me. On the ground, my society some say I'm no good, but I'm the meanest rapper in the neighborhood. I'm the alien with rhymes, the one who's getting down. I'm the royalty of rappers, the one who wears the crown.
What are you doing with all the girly gold jewelry?
Stand back, bro, and let me go with the flow, because it's a Yule time. It's a cool time. And brother Z, it's your turn to rap.
Oh, yeah, so I've got to do this rap
yeah,
stuff.
Come on.
Yeah? Okay, right then. Well, Christmas is coming, Justin's getting fat, Stubby is blue and Zag is still a twat. Christmas pudding with cucumbers on top, I go hyperactive with all the fizzy pop. Ooh yeah,
you call me a twat.
Yeah, yeah, twat.
Thanks very much. And he's a coming,
and he's a running,
he's got eight reindeer
and lots of good cheer.
He's a moving,
well he's a grooving. Hey Santa baby, why don't you break it down?
Okay, first Christmas song of 2026.
I was restraining myself from singing along, but I can confirm that I know every syllable of that off by heart.
Excellent. Okay. Favourite albums? You've given us a few. So tell us about your choices, please.
I think like a lot of people who come on, a lot of my, a lot of the music I'm deeply attached to came to me when I was kind of in my late teens and I was moving out of home. So I left home when I was 17 and moved to Cork City. And I just love Cork so much from the second I arrived there. And on the second round in the CAO, I was offered my first place, which was in Trinity in Dublin. And I said no, because I already loved Cork so much. Oh my God. So a huge
You're
part,
being from where originally?
I'm from Clare originally. And I get heckled when I go home to Clare because of my accent.
No, you sound pure Cork.
it's just such a good accent. I think when I first came to Cork, I fell in with a lovely gang of people and we used to all go to Freak Scene at Sir Henry's, which was like a great club that was happening in Cork at the time. And it was a lot of it was alternative music and I got really into loads of amazing music. But when I listen to the Pixies now and the volume is loud enough that I can kind of feel it behind my breastbone, like that kind of thud there, oh my God, I'm right back being 17 again. In Sir Henry's and moshing about the place.
Let's hear from Doolittle, Gouge Away by the Pixies.
Gouge away. You can gouge away. Stay all day if you want to.
Pixies and Gouge Away from Doolittle. You've also mentioned the Tindersticks and Cameron Winter.
Yeah, I love Tindersticks and I really associate Tindersticks with that time in my life as well, late teens, early 20s. And oh, just so beautiful, you know, and there's such depth to Tindersticks lyrics that it's another one of those kind of time machine bands for me. It just sends me right back to those years in Cork. Cameron Winter I've gotten really into recently, and Geese, who are his band. And there's been loads of controversy in the news in recent weeks saying that, oh, he's like a media plant or something. All this Geese stuff. Why does everyone like Geese all of a sudden? It's because they've done this guerrilla kind of like a digital marketing campaign or something. I am here to say I listen to this stuff a stupid number of times, and I'm such a lyrics person. Like I write poetry. That's bizarrely part of my job. And to me, they're so solid. I love the way Cameron Winter sings, and I love their lyrics. It's just so spectacular. It just puts me somewhere else entirely. It's solid artistically. So I don't care what it took to get us to a 45-year-old woman in Ireland. I love it.
Well, let's hear a little bit of Geese. I'll pay the cocaine.
You can stay with me.
Okay, you've got me interested. I hadn't been familiar with Geese. Gigs. Are you going to go back to Cork in the 90s when you came to college for one of your favourite gigs?
Do I ever leave Cork? That's what you're learning about me. All of my cultural references are somehow related to Cork. I suppose like I'm not really a gigs person because I'm not great in crowds. I get kind of freaked out and I don't drink anymore. But back when I was a drinker and I was more able for crowds, I was at a really amazing gig by Fugazi and Nancy Spains in the late 90s, but I don't remember much of it, to be honest. And when I was thinking about gigs, there's another one that stands out for me is Arcade Fire played at Electric Picnic in 2005, and it was right after Funeral came out. And it was one of those experiences of being in a crowd where for once I didn't feel panicky. It was like this huge surge of human energy all joining in song and carrying the chorus of Wake Up together. And there was something so powerful about that. It was like the best moments of like an All-Ireland. I'm so bad at crowds, I don't even go to All-Ireland anymore. But like it was like those best moments where they're like an amazing goal is scored and the whole crowd just almost lifts and you no longer feel like just one human being. You're like part of something bigger. And that's how I felt in that Arcade Fire gig. It was amazing.
Favorite movie, actor or director? You have given us a movie, Meyrowitz Stories.
Yeah, new and selected Meyrowitz Stories. This is directed by Noah Baumbach and it's really funny. That's the first thing I want to say. Also, it's on Netflix. So if you feel like watching it, you probably have a Netflix subscription. A lot of people do. And it's got so many brilliant actors. Adam Sandler, Ben Stiller, Dustin Hoffman, Emma Thompson. And what I love about it is it's grappling with themes that we rarely see in film. It is looking very closely at what it is to be a minor artist and what that means for powerful egos within a single family. Like if you are raised with the idea all your life that your father is like this amazing major artist and that's why he's constantly behaving badly and putting his family second and that kind of thing. And then as he comes to his older age, it starts to become clear, oh, maybe we were slightly wrong about this. What was all that for? He's an artist, but he's maybe not the major artist that he hoped all his life he would be and that we presumed he was. And it just explores those kind of family tensions and dynamics in a really, really interesting, funny way. And it really shows, oh my God, Adam Sandler's character is amazing in it because he is a pure artist and he's like a composer and he performs these really funny little songs but has devoted his adult life to caring for his child who is now like going on to college and he has to grapple with that, who he is in his life and parenting and as an artist. It's just such a heartwarming film, but also it's one of those ones that'll make you laugh and cry, to reach for a cliche, but oh, I love it so much.
You also have Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yeah.
We're going to play a clip, actually.
Oh, great.
With Gary Oldman and Keanu Reeves.
Should you leave these rooms? You will not by any chance go to sleep in any other part of the castle. It is old and has many bad memories. Be warned.
I'm sure I understand.
Do not put your faith in such trinkets of deceit. We are in Transylvania. Transylvania is not England. Our ways are not your ways. And to you, there shall be many strange things.
I've seen many strange things already. Bloody wolves chasing me through some blue inferno.
Listen to them.
Gary Oldman clearly enjoying himself, sir.
Yeah, the accent is brilliant. The Children of the Night, what beautiful music they make. I absolutely love him in this role. And like the film itself, it is so camp, but it has got the most lush costumes. Like when Coppola was talking about it, he said that rather than paying acute attention to the set designs, the costumes were where it was all going to be, and that really comes across. They're extraordinary, but Gary Oldman's performance, like the whole film is so camp, it's almost hilarious, but it's also really lush and there's a lot of heart in it, and I mean, yeah, it's sentimental, and Keanu Reeves is being Keanu Reeves, you know, he's exactly like he sounds like Cliff, he's kind of wooden. But I like that. And oh my God, I just love that film. I can't tell you how many times I've watched it, Matt. I really have watched it over and over again. And every time I enjoyed it, it's great crack and it's beautiful still. It stands up. Watch it again, everybody.
You've nominated two directors, Peter Strickland. What movie in particular?
Peter Strickland, I feel, is a genius. I really like In Fabric. I just happened upon this. I can't even remember how I ended up watching it. It's like the story, it's a story of a haunted dress and this really weird haunted department store that it's bought from. And it does really strange things with language, with this strange, almost monstrous staff that live in this department store. They speak English in a way that it really functions like poetry. You're going to have to watch it to see what I mean. Okay. But the dress is haunted in a bad way.
Okay, you like the ghosts, clearly.
I do.
And Jonathan Glazer, who's done two brilliant movies in the last decade, The Fall and Zone of Interest.
Yeah, I loved Zone of Interest. It explores World War II in a way that I think we hadn't seen it before. Like, you know, we're the viewer haunting a house that is right beside Auschwitz, and we are watching people just come and go there. And I was so deeply moved by Zone of Interest. I think about it all the time, and I'm haunted to the core by a scene towards the end, which isn't a spoiler, where we see a Nazi look down a dark corridor. That's all I need to say. He just looks down a dark corridor. And when I think of it, it still gives me goosebumps and freaks me out. So that is fantastic, that film, The Zone of Interest. But there's a short film of his called The Fall that's like, it's in a forest and it's really abstract. There are people, but they are masked and they're moving at speed and chasing other people. And it's like a hunt. But then somehow the trees move in a really weird way and there's a well. It's bizarre. But I would really recommend watching that if you can. It's very short. It's only like 10 minutes long.
Okay. Now, favourite plays. You've gone for Beckett's Happy Days with Siobhan McSweeney, Beckett's Number One with Regina Crowley. Why so?
Well, when I was talking earlier about the hospital in which my book is based, when it stopped being a hospital and was slowly turned into really beautiful modern apartments as it is now, they changed the name from the wards' names that they used to be in the hospital, and they named them after famous Irish writers. So I don't know how much Yeats would like having a wing named after him, but there's the Yeats and there's the Beckett, and it just seemed such a funny connection to me to the hospital. So Beckett, yeah, I don't know very much about theatre, so I tend to approach it in a way where I'm kind of half baffled but really enjoying it at the same time. And I, through Cork Midsummer Festival, who are fantastic and design amazing theatre in Cork, and that's spectacular for all of us, we get to experience things like Beckett. So I got to see Siobhan McSweeney a few years ago doing Happy Days, and that was amazing. Like, I wasn't expecting, not knowing a lot about Beckett when I would go in, that like there's this character, Winnie, she was playing, who's like buried increasingly as the play goes on. She's buried like to the waist, she's buried to the neck, and she's still trying to put kind of a brave face on things. Oh my God, I hadn't realised how hilarious Beckett can be as well. And so I loved that experience. But there was another Beckett performance, again, as part of Cork Midsummer Festival, that was on in the Crawford Art Gallery. And this was Not I, which it was the way I think that they designed it in some way. Like, they made great use of a gallery space where we were welcomed as the audience and blindfolded, Matt. And that is an experience that I found really strange. Like, so couldn't see it all. You're being led by the elbow down through the building, and you come to a room where someone is going to recite Not I to you so fast. And I think it was Regina Crowley who was playing the part that time. So quick, the text, it moves so fast. You barely have time to absorb it. And it's like an onslaught of speech. Oh my God, I still think about it all the time.
Okay, we're nearly out of time, so I'm not going to be able to play any more clips. So quickly, I'm going to have to go through your books and authors. You've got a book of poems you want to recommend.
Yeah, this is my absolute favourite book of poems, and I read a lot of poetry. It's called Stay Illusion. It's by Lucy Brock Broido, and it was one of those fluke findings. I was in a secondhand bookshop on Valentia Island, and I picked up this beautiful book and opened it, and it's full of the poems of my life. I adore this book so much. And it's such a fluke because she lived in America. What was this book doing randomly in a secondhand shop on Valentia Island? I'm so glad I picked it up.
Author Anne Enright?
Oh, yeah. Genius. Again, like, such a genius. And I love her novels so much. But she has a book out this year called Attention, which I really recommend because it's full of briefer essays that she has written over the years. And she writes beautifully about, like, Ireland's really dark institutional history. But she also writes really incisively about other writers. And I was particularly taken with an essay about John McGahern here. Must read that one.
I see your current favourite is The Fallen by Louise Brangan. I need to go on, though. Children's television, clearly The Den, yes. Yeah. And the Batman reruns on RT and Saturday mornings with Adam West. Why have you picked The Rehearsal as your current favourite?
This is Nathan Fielder. He is such a strange mind, and I love him for it. So you can get this, I think, on Now TV in Ireland. And he came up with this idea. Why do plane crashes happen? Is it possibly because there isn't sufficient communication between pilot and co-pilot, and that there's some kind of communication breakdown, and that's why the plane crashes? And it's very hard to give a synopsis, like anyone who knows Nathan Fielder will tell you, but it is hilarious. it's thought-provoking and just like increasingly bizarre with these weird real-life experiments that he does, where you're looking at whoever you're watching telly with and going, is this real? Is this really happening here?
I hate rushing you because I love hearing you give your explanations, but I am going to finish the cultural buried treasure we asked somebody for, and you've come up with somebody called Francis Higgins. Who is Francis Higgins?
I know I've said the word genius a few times, right? Oh my God, Francis Higgins is a genius. Now that is a pseudonym, okay? Like, and this is like a spin-off from the Hardy books, but what you're seeing is a genius human imagination spinning off wildly into a new iteration where you can like just look him up on YouTube. And what I would suggest is first looking up Francis Higgins and Zurich. It begins like it's an ad for Zurich, and it just takes you on a very strange adventure into the mind of this character. And from there, you just have to follow him, and you're going to find Tommy Schlug, you're going to find Conor Williams, you're going to find Fontaine. But most of all, you are going to find him in a tunnel somewhere, reciting verbatim, my God, Frank McCourt versus Jerry Hannon on that iconic Late Late Show episode. And he does like a recitation you'd imagine when, like back in the day when people are going on course to people's houses and you stand up and say a poem. He says the whole thing start to finish. It is one of the moments of my entire cultural life. I watch it over and over again, and I'm not alone. I know there, I have many fellow fans out there, and I am singing his praises today.
Darren McGriffa, it's been brilliant having you on the Culture Club. Thank you so much. Congratulations on Said the Dead.
The Last Word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.